This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. This hour, a conversation with novelist Norman Mailer. Mailer died November 10th in New York, the city where he lived most of his life. He was 84. Mailer was famous for most of his life. He was only 25 when he published his first novel, a bestseller. The Naked and the Dead drew from his experiences fighting in the South Pacific in World War II. Mailer went on to write more than 36 books. Half a century ago, he co-founded The Village Voice. He wrote fiction and nonfiction, covered 6 national political conventions, won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, and even ran, unsuccessfully, in a primary for mayor of New York City. This year, Norman Mailer published his first major work of fiction in a decade. The Castle in the Forest tells the story of Adolf Hitler as seen through the eyes of a demon sent by the devil to cultivate an antichrist. Norman Mailer spoke about the book, his career, his life, and politics in January at New York City's Hunter College, part of the New York Times' Times Talks series. And this hour on Word for Word, we'll hear that talk, one of the last public presentations Norman Mailer made. Interviewing Norman Mailer was Sam Tannenhaus, editor of the New York Times Book Review.
Now, I told Norman backstage that I was going to read him something he wrote number of years ago, and I'm going to ask you to comment on it. He doesn't know what it is. He preferred not to know. It's from the early 1960s, and Norman Mailer wrote, "Hitler, to take the most odious example, was a hero. The hero is monster, embodying what had become the monstrous fantasy of a people, but the horror upon which the radical mind and liberal temperament foundered was that he gave outlet to the energies of the Germans and so presented the 20th century with an index of how horrible had become the secret heart of its desire." And I want to ask you now, Norm, if you remember those words and how present that notion was in your mind when you began work on this book, however many years ago you did.
I like those words very much. And, and in fact, I was admiring them as I listened. And I thought, yeah, I'd like to read the author, I guess. No, I think I do agree. And I think that's been the horror of Hitler. The double horror is that there were two peoples who truly believed that culture was the element that would solve human affairs and enrich societies and make for good societies in the future. And those two people were the Jews and the Germans. They each believed that an immersion in good culture was good for humanity. And so what happened, of course, which is obvious, is the country that put the greatest respect into culture ended up destroying virtually all, certainly almost all of the German Jews who also believed in culture. And that shock, I think, has paralyzed us and neutralized us and numbed us.
Now, was this
to a discernible degree, perhaps.
Was this a shock you grew up with? Something you're celebrated and sometimes criticized for as a great contemporary American novelist is not having written so much about your own Jewishness, your heritage, whereas other prominent novelists of your generation did. How present in your mind was the fact, the horrible fact of Hitlerism as you were growing up and as you were writing your first works?
Well, no, I grew up with it when I was 9 years old. I've said this a few times by now. But when I was 9 years old, my mother, who was an intelligent woman, very sensitive, and had a high school degree, no more, she knew that Hitler was going to kill all the Jews. She was terribly gloomy in 1932. She felt he's coming to power and he's going to be an absolute disaster for the Jews. And so at the age of 9, I already knew there was this awful man named Hitler who was out there who was going to kill all of us. And I was struck with later down the road, I thought about it. If there were all the experts in the world, all the statesmen, and the majority of them were saying, well, you know, Hitler will tone down when he gets a little power. Responsibility will make him less mad. He'll be all right. You know, he's not agreeable, he's unpleasant, but we can live with him. And they were wrong, and she was right. And that gave me this notion that you need never pay any excessive obeisance to experts.
So something that's interesting in this novel, for those of you who've read it or not had the chance to do it yet, is the tone and attitude of the narrator. Something that's lost in much of this discussion of the book is that it's not only about Hitler, it's also about the man who tells the story, which has been a preoccupation of yours for many, many years, the relation between the observer, the narrator, and the story he tells. How did you arrive at this particular voice? And how do you hear that voice in your head? Who is he?
The only difficulty I have with him, I love him as a narrator, this minor devil who tells the story, who's the assistant, an assistant to the devil, who claims that he's fairly high up in the ranks of devils, although you don't know, he offers no evidence for it. But he has the power to enter the mind of a client. One of the notions in the book that gave me a great deal of enjoyment in writing it was that devils don't seize you the way it used to be seen in the Middle Ages, that you made one mistake and the devil swooped down and grasped you and your soul was lost forever. Rather, it's a long, arduous process to ruin a human soul. And they work at it very hard. It's very bureaucratic. They go to great lengths, these devils, to keep their clients intact. They're faced and confronted all the time by angels whom they call cudgels. The demons call the angels cudgels because the cudgels tend to beat them up when they find them. And I just love this, the idea of two warring bureaucracies, one subtle and insidious, looking for clients, and the other, these cudgels, being a little bit like Marines and just beating the hell out of devils whenever they found them. And that just hinted at in the book. But the notion of a devil appealed to me greatly because it's hard to explain, but when you write novels, the person who tells the story is crucial to at least half the success of a novel, I would say, depends on how the story is told. Is it told by one person sitting in their own mind and giving you objective external descriptions of everyone else? Or do you have an omniscient narrator, which was common to the 19th century novel, where literally you have to assume that this person has godly powers and can enter every single mind? And that worked very well for the 19th century, because I think then they believed in God, most people. Most people who read novels believed in God in the 19th century. I think it's a fair generalization. And therefore, the novelist to them could be analogous to God for the sake of enjoying the fiction.
Does that mean most of the novelists also believed in God?
No, not necessarily. It was just that they just loved... It was just easy to enter everyone's mind. You could do it. And now you can't. With the modern canon, which really feels that they got rid of a lot of medieval nonsense through the Enlightenment of the last few centuries, and that this most people can do without God and the devil by now, most people who read novels. They certainly don't want them intruding. And so the notion is that you stay in one intelligence, in one consciousness. You don't try to cover everything, cover everyone. And that's inhibiting. You get into a lot of problems of development when you're writing a novel, when you can only have the consciousness of your narrator. Is that clear to all of you? Does someone not know what I'm talking about?
Well, certainly many in the audience will know that you've experimented with different points of view in many of the books. You've referred to yourself in the third person as Mailer. You called yourself Aquarius once. The first and third person problem is one that you've worked with for many years, right?
Well, yes, I've wrestled with it, you might say, and never felt that I'd successfully gotten to the point where I wanted to get, which is very often in the course of writing a book, you know a great deal, or think you do, about the internal workings of certain characters' minds. But if you're locked into the first person, you can't then jump into their mind with authority. So you have to hint at it. You go roundabout to it. And here, with this devil, because he was a devil, he had the ability to enter various people's minds, particularly the client. He could enter his client's minds. He could enter the minds, to a lesser degree, of the people around the clients. In other words, if he had a child who was a client, he could approach the mind of the father and the mother, know more about them than the average person would. And so this is very complicated as I describe it, but very easy in the book. And that was supposed to be a witty comment.
Another question I have, one of the most remarkable decisions you made as an artist, one of the great risks you take in the novel, is to describe the very young Hitler. This is exactly the opposite of what a reader might expect. They might expect to see the young Hitler in Vienna developing his anti-Semitic fixations, but you actually describe his parents and then Hitler as a child. And what made you choose to do that? Why give us the very young, even infant Hitler?
Originally, I was going to call the book Hitler's Mother, because I was fascinated with her. Fascinated because as I did the research, it seemed to me reasonably clear and reasonably certain that she was a fine woman. She was a good, hardworking woman, very modest, certainly had no large opinion of herself, very subservient if she had a fault. And she adored Hitler. And I thought, that is really where you begin to find the beginnings of a certain kind of tragedy, when you have a mother who adores a child, and the child turns out a monster. It's part of the immense demand of life itself, that no matter how careful you are, and how much love, indeed, you'll even offer, that doesn't mean that you have, that any one element in your makeup can solve the problems of life. And so I wanted to write this book called Hitler's Mother. And in the course of writing it, and therefore it was automatic that Adolf would be born and so forth, it didn't occur to me that I would get into the later Hitler. I also had the advantage and the interest that there was not that much written about his childhood. And I felt, and I'd read the few good books in English about it, about his childhood, that I had a lot more to offer for various reasons, including the number. Well, I won't get to that. And so I started writing it, but then what happened is, which is part of the fun of writing a novel, is that the father took on more and more importance and developed more and more, and finally he became one of my best characters ever. I mean, he's not even a particularly nice man, but I loved him because he was such a good character for me. I could do so much with him. I didn't care that he... he was a beer drinker and he smoked cigars and blew the smoke into his kids' faces. I didn't mind that his pride was that he had made love to three sisters in a family and therefore had taken care of the entire family. I didn't mind that he was a man who prided himself on how many women he could make love to. There was never a cook or a chambermaid who was safe around him. All that he loved because he was accustomed to
it. And much of this is in the novel, by the way.
Yeah, this is not. Oh, this is not myself. No, 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 no. I admired his simplicity and strength as a character. He was so easy to write about. You could do so much with him. He was so vain on the one hand, so modest on the other. He was a poor peasant who had worked his way up as a customs official in the Viennese customs service. He was a fascinating character, and he was a brute toward young Adolf. So I could have called the book at a certain point Hitler's Father, but then who would give a damn? So had I given up Hitler's Mother, at that point I decided it was going to be Hitler's book after all. And so he developed more and more as the book went on. And finally, he got to the point of 16, where he's semi-formed. In other words, he's not the only Hitler that could have come along. The notion I had was that the devil invested in any number of promising children, because the devil was planning somebody like Hitler, wanted someone like Hitler, and was planning that. But he had maybe 1,000 candidates at that point. It was Hitler developed into Hitler later. He wasn't a confirmed success at that point in the book.
We've talked about the devil. Let me read you something you wrote about God. I think that the particular God we can conceive of is a God whose relationship to the universe we cannot divine. That is, how enormous he is in the scheme of the universe, we can't begin to say. But almost certainly, he is not all-powerful. He exists as a warring element in a divided universe, and we are a part of it, perhaps the most important part of it, his great expression, his enormous destiny. Perhaps he is trying to impose upon the universe his conception of being against other conceptions of being very much opposed to his. Maybe we are, in a sense, the seed carriers, the voyagers, the explorers, the embodiment of that embattled vision. Maybe we are engaged in a heroic activity and not a mean one. And what this will remind readers of course, is that your previous novel was about Jesus.
Yes.
And for those who followed your career very closely, you established yourself as a great chronicler of America, American history, American passions, American madness, American politics. Yet in your recent novels, you've often moved away from that. You've looked at the broader scope of history. How did that happen and why?
I'm not certain I can answer it. I would say that I think I probably felt that I had written about America as much as I wanted to and could write, and that if I kept writing about America, I might be repeating myself. And I've always felt that one has to stick to one's virtues as an artist. And if I had a virtue, it was that I would do something different every time. I had a huge admiration for Picasso, and certainly not for his writing, which was dreadful. But his art was exceptional because it was as if he felt that there were any number of approaches to reality, and he was determined to explore as many of them as he possibly could. And it was as if he had been a mountaineer and had a particularly difficult rock face to climb, he would have tried it from many a different approach. In other words, he was always trying to scale the heights of reality with one technique or another, and they were often completely opposed techniques. That had nothing to do, you could never tell as he went from one phase to another that the same artist had even done the work. And I was impressed with that, and I just felt that I was used up on writing about America. I must have felt that. I didn't say to myself at a given moment, hey, you're used up in writing about America, because it doesn't work that way. What happens is that you get the idea that you want to write a certain kind of novel, and you're excited by the idea that you have a novel, because I've said this many times, but you can always decide to do a piece of nonfiction. You can sit down with your publisher and your agent, and you can make a contract. You say, I'll start in a month, or I'll need 3 months for the research, and you do it. And it's a professional job, and you do it. But with a novel's like falling in love. You can't say, I'm going to be very much in love in 2 weeks. You can't do that. And so it happens. And when a novel happens, you're immensely happy. It's as if something deep in your unconscious has said, all right, now you've got another chance to do a novel. And you don't argue with it. You don't say, I'm not prepared to write about Jesus Christ. Suddenly it just occurred to me, I've got a novel there. I can write a novel about the New Testament because it's the most curious book. It's got wonderful sayings in it, but it's an abominably written book, obviously written by a committee of talentless literary people who were interested. No, they were interested in propaganda. They wanted to sell Jesus. And in it, you had these wonderful remarks by Jesus. There also was an extraordinary story in it. Here's the story of a relatively ordinary young carpenter who's settled upon by God to be his son. That is, God knows in advance, and so through the angel, what an interesting Freudian remark that was. Through the angel Gabriel, God impregnates Mary, and the Son of God is born. Now I thought, now that's an existential situation. There you are. Try to imagine that you're Jesus. You think you're a human, but you know you have exceptional powers that you really don't comprehend. And that was how I tried to write that book. And I'm not certain I succeeded. I think that book may have been much too much for me. I may not have succeeded at all with that book. I don't know. By now, I hardly care. You do your books, they succeed or they fail, and you never know what's going to happen to them down the road. Either they disappear completely or they're picked up again. That's not important. But what was important to me is I thought Hitler's the opposite number to Jesus. Right. That if Jesus was sired by Gabriel for God, then Hitler was sired by the devil and was the devil's answer to Jesus Christ. And that to me was exciting, and I felt I really wanted to do some work with that.
Did it ever occur to you to choose another villain, or was Hitler was the obvious one? You've grown up with the idea of him and the reality of him.
It had to be Hitler. It had to be Hitler. If I continue with this book, if I remain young enough in some small part of me to keep writing, which is not routine, but if I do, I think the next book would be not only about Hitler, but about Himmler, because Himmler was awful, absolutely awful. He looked awful. You know, he was a most unpleasant-looking man, and he was a monster, absolute monster, more of a monster even than Hitler. But he was much deeper and brighter than Hitler, and more creative in a funny way. He had all sorts of wonderful, crazy ideas along with all the monstrosities. So it might be interesting to do a book on Hitler and Himmler if I were to go on. But this is just, you know, at the age of 83, 84, you have to be careful not to natter.
You know, or you're certainly not nattering tonight. You remind me of when your comments before about the difficulty of omniscience. Something that's striking is that your remarkable very first novel was written in an omniscient voice.
I didn't know better. It's the truth. I was an absolute amateur. I didn't realize that point of view has almost a religious intensity for most serious novelists. At that time, all I thought was, hey, just write the book. Enter everybody's head. You know these guys. You were in the army with them. Just write it. In other words, it was an amateur's book. That's part of its virtue. It just wasn't scared. I wasn't afraid of my literary betters when I wrote the book.
And when did you start become conscious of these complications? You said at one point, this may have been in the late 50s, that you began as one kind of writer and became another kind.
Yes. Well, after I was successful, I began to think, I want Partisan Review to like me. And that was very good for me and very bad for me, both.
Wait, you outlasted them. You outlasted them, Partisan Review.
No, but I became part of them at one point, to a degree. And I learned an immense amount from them. And in effect, what I felt was that I had been immensely lucky with The Naked and the Dead because I'd had the kind of experience that was perfect for a young novelist. It enabled me, it shot me out of a cannon in terms of my future life, because my life was changed completely by that book. But what I also knew is I had an awful lot to learn about writing. I didn't feel that I was a true writer yet. I still felt like an amateur. Somebody, after I'd done some writing in college, I'd won a college contest, it made my family happy. I went to the Army. I used to write letters to my then-wife, Beatrice, about events in the Army. I used those as notes for The Naked and the Dead. And the book had come out. The book had been written very naturally. It was written in 15 months with a great gusto. I used to write 28 pages a week, I remember. Mm-hmm. Used to be my stint. And wrote the book in about 10 months and edited it in about 3 or 4 and went off to Europe. And then 6 months later, 8 months later, it was on the bestseller list and stayed there. And all of that was unreal. I had an identity crisis. And the identity crisis took the form, as I adjusted to it. I didn't even know what an identity crisis was. We didn't have that term in those days. I wish we had it, because it would have saved me 6 months or so, trying to figure out who I am and what I am and where am I and why am I and so forth.
Well, you have said, written, that one of the difficulties, The Naked and the Dead, for those of you who don't remember, was published in 1948 when Norman was 25 years old. It made him a household name, made him the most celebrated writer of a very gifted new generation. And you have written that the celebrity and attention it brought to you was actually in some way debilitating to you as a writer. You could no longer be the anonymous observer. Somehow you were the story yourself. And did that create part of the crisis that you had to work through as a writer? Did it also raise a question of your relationship to your material, whether you're the I?
Absolutely, all of that. I remember when Kurt Vonnegut came along and William Kennedy came along, I admired the way they, I thought they each had worked hard for a number of years. They were 30, 35, and 40, more or less, when they began to be recognized as the immensely talented novelists they were, and they became successful, and they were ready for it. And I remember thinking, feeling wistful, and thinking, yes, they put in enough years of being out of the spotlight to enjoy the spotlight when they hit it. I hated the spotlight. I felt, I have a few habits. The habits I have are that nobody pays much attention to me, and there I am, I can observe and observe. I see what people are doing. I learn. I think about this person, that person. And now suddenly, it's no longer possible. Now if I go into a room, everybody says, oh, that's Norman Mailer. He wrote that book that's number one on the bestseller list. And there you are. Suddenly you... I've always felt I had a visceral understanding of movie stars who almost always are shot out of cannons. That is, one year they're unknown, and 2 years later they're a top box office star. And they have these odd, weird lives that are disjunctive. And I always felt I understood that, that in an odd way, although I certainly didn't have the properties of the physical properties of a movie star, I had the psychological difficulties of one.
And to some extent, that became one of your subjects.
Yes, yes.
The scrutiny, also the obligation almost to perform in a public way. You got involved in politics. Many will remember that Norman Mailer ran for mayor of New York. There's the great book, Armies of the Night, in which you address protesters. And there's a sense there that there's a kind of gamble that you have to take in a public way. They're almost the novelist on stage. Was that exciting? Was it satisfying for you? Or?
I think it developed bit by bit. I was immensely taken with Hemingway, because when I became a novelist, the great novelists in America were much more important to me than politicians. I wouldn't say they were greater in my mind than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But by the time I was reasonably successful, we had smaller people as president. Eisenhower, who in memory now is a fairly good president, at the time I used to scorn him. He didn't compare to Hemingway or Faulkner, as far as I was concerned, or to Steinbeck. And so, given this notion that novelists are immensely important, the feeling I had is that we are the ones who make history. We're the ones who should make history. And I felt it was incumbent on one to be seen as a public figure. Now, I also obviously enjoyed it, or I wouldn't have done it. I found that I had, in those days, a certain flair for appearing in public. I was better at it than I thought I would be. I might still be shy in a good many ways, but get out on the stage, and I wasn't. I was bold. And I loved the idea of saying something very bold on the stage to to an audience of unknown people and getting a reaction. So in that sense, I was a bit of a natural, you might say.
Norman Mailer, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, died November 10th at the age of 84, and you're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. Now, back to New York Times book review editor Sam Tannenhaus, who interviewed Mailer in January at New York City's Hunter College.
You also like shocking liberals. Norman has written what I think is the single greatest passage on Richard Nixon, who's a fascination of mine. I'm going to read it to you. If Richard Nixon had been standing alone on the street and 1,000 nonviolent liberals had been standing around him with flails, they would have beaten each other to death in their rush to get at him. This is written at the time of Watergate. They would have drowned in each other's slobber in the fury to beat him to a pulp. Richard Nixon had intensified the demonic lust to destroy in all those good, compassionate, Judeo-Christian, liberal atheists. He had scorched reason a little further out of existence.
Forced what?
Scorched reason. Reason. Further out of existence. Yes. And something I've always meant to ask you about is, because I write a fair amount myself about conservatism, is how you had an almost visceral feel for the power of the ascendant conservative movement. It's actually in The Naked and the Dead, when the general, the MacArthur-like general, talks about the coming age of fascism. What were the censors? How were you able to pick up this sense of a shift in the culture? What were you looking at that moment?
Well, I, as a tender liberal, who had never questioned the values of liberalism, suddenly was in the Army. And in the Army, what you found is that the, how to put it, the most virile soldiers, the toughest soldiers, were almost always conservative in their opinions and highly opinionated. And we as liberals were a little afraid of them in the Army. And I began to realize that there was, if you divided up all of America into liberals and conservatives, and they met each other on a field of war without weapons, just with their bodies, the conservatives would win.
Is that still true?
It's much trickier, but it may still be true, yes. By now, however, it'd be the conservatives who would be blind with rage and flails. Because what happened in those years, those early years, liberals had an uneasy conscience in a number of ways. Because they were obtaining, in my opinion, they were obtaining more power than they deep down secretly felt they deserved. Roosevelt had opened a broad highway for them. But today, I think the conservatives have taken on all sorts of powers that they don't deserve. And I think they have an immensely bad secret conscience about Iraq, because they knew, they had to know, that they were violating every conservative principle when they invaded Iraq and when they gave their assent to President Bush. I think they have a bad conscience that they even selected a man like President Bush, because if you're serious about your politics, you just don't choose a cheerleader to be your president.
You once described yourself as a left conservative. Is that what you are still?
Oh, more than ever, more than ever. But don't ask me to define it. I can't. I really can't. I try. I try to explain it, and I fumper. I feel probably that there are no there are no ultimate truths in political positions, and that if we really want to understand what a better world would be, one is happier if one's able to, I wouldn't say oscillate, but teeter-totter, if you will, or balance between opposed points of view. In other words, let's say there are days when I feel that I'm more liberal than conservative and vice versa. That comes very often as a reaction to events out there. Certainly, the business of Bush in Iraq made me much more leftist than I'd been in quite a few years, because I felt this was absolutely outrageous.
From the beginning?
From the beginning. Before it all began, I must say I was opposed to Bush even before 9/11. I was opposed to him for a different reason, which I've always felt that a democracy depends upon good language in the leaders. That it's, no, but that's so true. It's so true if you think about it. People pattern themselves in a democracy after their leaders. Franklin Delano Roosevelt made people classier, just nicer. They had better manners. They had more style. It was as if Roosevelt was saying to America, one of the things we should have in a democracy is good style, and he helped to produce that. He was a great president, greater than maybe any of the others. But when Bush came along, he was this ignoramus who didn't read books and who could not speak good English, whose words, whose vocabulary consisted of 5-word slogans and 8-word slogans and, at its worst, 18-word slogans, like we're going to defeat the forces of terrorism in the Middle East and bring democracy there so all those people there can enjoy what they want the most, freedom, all one word.
Right.
So I felt he was a disaster before 9/11.
Now, you also admired, in a complicated way, John F. Kennedy. And what was the quality you thought he might bring to American culture beyond politics?
Well, at that time, I felt that we'd been stultified by the Eisenhower years and by the complacency of the right wing, the complacency of the Republicans who loved Eisenhower and loved, America was perfect. There was nothing wrong with America. There was a certain blindness about our virtues as a nation. We were just infatuated with ourselves for too little. We'd won the war. We'd won the Second World War. But the fact of the matter is that we hadn't paid the heavy price for that, winning that war. The Russians had. And here we were making them the evil empire even then, although we didn't use the words yet. But we saw them as a great threat to us. We hated them. We hated Fidel Castro. Why? America's political leaders hated Fidel Castro because he had more guts than they did. He'd started his war with 16 people after he lost 2/3 of his forces landing in a remote part of Cuba and they were ambushed. He had 16 people left. Even then, he didn't lose faith, and he went forward, and he built in Cuba, and he won. He conquered the country. He was a heroic man. And all these politicians in America who were facing him How would they come to power? They'd come to power by shaking hands with people they despised.
You run through
an open... They'd kiss the famous part of the human anatomy that is unnameable.
Let me read you something else that struck me when I was very young. I have been running for president these last 10 years in the privacy of my mind. You wrote that in 1959.
In 1959.
And what strikes me about it now is I think that's true for everybody. We all kind of imagine ourselves as president.
Absolutely. No,
and
absolutely.
Do you still do this?
I'm a little too old for that. I have a wife who would leave me if I ever took the idea seriously. When I ran for mayor, I did have this absolutely romantic, insane notion that we'd win the election and I'd make a wonderful mayor and then I could run for president.
You have spoken tonight very emphatically about the singularity of the novel, and yet many here will know you're probably the most accomplished, certainly the most ambitious nonfiction writer of the last half century in America. And you've said yourself that you approach everything really as if it's a kind of fiction. When you wrote a book like The Executioner's Song, which I'm sure many here will agree is one of probably the handful of great American books published in the last 40 or 50 years, there you must have felt yourself as both novelist and nonfiction writer.
No, I was stubborn and really even dogged about it, that it was a novel from the word go. Yes, it was all nonfiction. But I decided it was going to be written in the style of a novel. At that point, it seemed terribly important to me to make a point, which is if something is written in the style of a novel, then it is a novel. Because we read books of nonfiction with a certain set to our buttocks that we don't have when we read a novel. And perhaps we lean forward a millimeter when we're reading a novel. I don't know. But there's a different air, aura of reception about nonfiction and fiction. I always used to say, suppose I called Gary Gilmore Harry Kilmore or Harry Wilmore. At that point, ipso facto, it's a novel, if I make up all the names. And what are you going to do then? It's just a highly realistic novel. So I thought, let's not even bother to get into that. Let's use the names and still call it a novel. But as you were speaking earlier about nonfiction and fiction, why I was good at it and why I liked it and why I prospered in it, it occurred to me I did have an outrageous thought, which is the difference between the novel and nonfiction, nonfictional reporting, that is, not serious, heavy nonfiction about, the variant channels in the iliac bone. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about popular nonfiction, when you describe events that occurred and so forth, which is what I did. It's a little bit like the difference between falling in love and having a sexual relationship that consists of falling in love, as opposed to going to a brothel. And the reason is you can have marvelous sex in a brothel, absolutely marvelous sex in a brothel. But there are certain things that are agreed from the beginning, which is the odds are very, it's almost unlikely that you or the whore are going to fall in love. And you're going to pay for it in a very simple way, whereas in love you pay for it in all sorts of unforeseen ways. So if you have that kind of appetite, and many of us have had that kind of appetite over many years in our lives, you're happy when you go to a brothel because you know exactly what you're going to get. You can look forward to it, and you can even be 90% correct. You certainly have every reasonable expectation of being 70% correct on how the evening is going to turn out. Whereas with a novel, you just don't know.
So you weren't surprised at all when you were writing a book like The Armies of the Night, which is history.
No,
of
that
novel,
was different.
The novel is history.
That was different. That was altogether different. Because that wasn't, when I did nonfiction, I'd do a certain amount of research. And I would lay it out for myself. And it had the happy faculty that I knew exactly what was going to happen, whereas in a novel, you worry about what your protagonist is going to do next. So in that sense, nonfiction was much simpler. That's why I use the analogy of the brothel. It's much simpler. You're going to have your act, and then you're going to go home that night. You're not going to take the lady home,
right?
Except one time in 500 or whatever. And
And then what happens? You marry her, and the difficulties begin.
That's an exceptional novel. But with the... what the devil was I about to say? Oh, Lord. I'm next to losing it at this point. I did have something interesting to say besides the brothel. I guess I shocked myself by using that example.
And there's a bibliography in this book, for those of you who've read it, and I assume Ron Rosenbaum's Explaining Hitler was a book that must have been a...
That had more effect on writing this book than any other book, yes.
Why?
Well, Ron Rosenberg wrote this marvelous book called Explaining Hitler, where he interviewed about 15 people who were well qualified to understand Hitler, people like Alan Bullock and certain Israeli scholars and all over the place. And each one had a different notion of what made Hitler tick. Ron was trying to find out for his own satisfaction, could he find the answer of, could Hitler be explained? And when I read the book, I was prodigiously stimulated by it.
And then decided
at a certain point, I have as much to say as any of the people in this book, and secretly I think I have more to say. And which is the feeling you need. You need that sense of superiority in a funny way, that I was talking about earlier. This feeling that you have a special purchase on a subject.
Well, doesn't this also take us back to this idea of, that you mentioned right at the start, not showing obeisance to experts. The novelist has a special avenue access to a kind of knowledge that will be forbidden to the expert.
The novel allows you to bypass experts on a subject, yes. I have a stronger feeling than that. I really feel that novels, precisely because they are not factual, enable us to understand our existence better than factual books. Because facts are always skewed. The more one deals with facts, the more one discovers that any given fact you have at a given moment is slightly warped at best. And we tend to build our understanding of matters on collections of facts that don't even necessarily associate well with each other, but we've absorbed the facts. I think it's one of the reasons why experts do well to win half their suggestions, to be right 50% of the time. It's because facts distort reality, whereas a novelist working alone can very often come up with a notion of existence that doesn't have to be accurate, certainly doesn't have to be factual, but it can create, it's almost as if a creature, a psychic creature is created that can pass over to other people and improve their brain so that they begin to see reality in more interesting ways and they begin to have a deeper sense of what their notion of reality might be. The point of the novel is to open consciousness for people, which facts don't always do. Facts often close up consciousness in that when we argue, we say, well, look at what the facts are. In other words, I'm not interested in opening your consciousness at that point. I'm interested in winning the argument.
Let me ask one more question, and then we'll take questions from the audience. Are you working on something now?
Not at the moment. I'm flogging my book at this point.
Something nonfiction writers and novelists have in common.
Well, I hope to get into... I'd like to be able to write one more novel. And, you know, novels take 2 or 3 years. So at the I'm going to be 84 in a week. So what that means is I have to count on the next 3 years to write another novel. 84, 85, 86. Well, I've seen people around me who go from 84 to 86, and they're a lot older at the end of those 3 years. Mm-hmm. It's as if once you get into your 80s, you deteriorate more quickly. So I'm not going to make any predictions that I've got another novel in me. I hope I do. We'll see. It's existential, my favorite word.
Writer Norman Mailer, who died November 10th. We're listening to a talk he gave at New York City's Hunter College in January, a few days before his 84th birthday, in what would be one of his last public appearances. Among other things, Mailer spoke about his latest and last novel, The Castle in the Forest, which is about Adolf Hitler. The event was sponsored by the New York Times as part of its Times Talk series, and you're hearing it on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. After his conversation with New York Times Book Review editor Sam Tenenhaus, Norman Mailer took some questions from the audience.
With choosing a subject for your next novel, from what you say, I sense that this is your last shot. And is there a paralysis in choosing the subject with that in mind? And I guess to follow that would be just, do you fear death?
I think generally when you get to work on a book, thankfully, I've never experienced paralysis. I find if I'm going to get interested in a book, it's because I get more and more interested in it until the point comes where I know I'm going to write it. And I do start. And very occasionally, once or twice in my life, I'd start a book and then have to give it up. But for the most part, there was a process going on that I could recognize, and I was confident about the outcome.
You don't have a shelf of abandoned novels, carcasses,
not really.
Wrecks, really?
Two or three, maybe, but you know, that long time ago.
And fearing death?
Fearing death is, I'm not going to brag and say I have no fear of death, but I've lived so long with the notion, since I have any number of religious ideas that involve, they don't involve a beatific heaven or a hideous hell. I think the fundamentalists are full of it. I believe in a creative God who's trying to do the best that he or she can do, very often against huge odds. And therefore, this God who's created us wants us to come back again because, like most artists, they want to improve on the earlier work. Now, that doesn't mean that your next birth, if you're reincarnated, because I believe most of us who die are reincarnated in one form or another. It doesn't mean that you're going to have something wonderful happen to you, that death is going to be Club Med. No. I have a joke I tell. I think I'll tell it one more time, which is, I die, and there I am. I discover myself sitting in a huge hall, a huge bureaucratic shed, waiting to be called up. Finally, the monitoring angel calls my name, and I go up there, and he says, well, hello, Mr. Mailer. We're very happy to see you. I want to tell you right off, don't want to keep you on tenterhooks, you've been passed for reincarnation. I say, oh, good, thank you. He said, now, we always ask anyone who's been passed for reincarnation what they'd like to be in their next life. And I will ask you that question, pro forma. So I say, well, I think I'd like to be a black athlete. And the monitoring angel says, oh, Mr. Mailer, we are so oversubscribed. I'm afraid I can't do anything for you there. Let me see what we've got you down for. So he opens this huge book and looks. And he says, oh, dear, he says, we've got you down for cockroach. He says, but this is the good news. You'll be the fastest cockroach on the block. All right. Well, the whole point is, you don't know what we're going to... I don't know what I'm going to get. I have no idea. I can't pretend that I know reincarnation exists. I have the feeling, hopefully, that I may have been around before and I may be around again. But I do have this feeling that death has got to be perhaps even more interesting than life, because it's very hard for me to conceive that everything we go through, all our lives, all our passions, all our frustrations, all our terrible disappointments, all the things that we wanted to be and failed to be, and all the things we succeeded in doing, all that rich texture of love and let me dare say it, hate, and various kinds of skewed passions and enthusiasms and disappointments and all that goes for nothing, and you just enter a world of nothingness or so-called peace or non-existence. No, I really think that this is a mix, that we live in a mix, and that this we're going to go on and become more or less as it goes on. Those are my thoughts about death.
Well, I take death as Club Med myself, but that's very persuasive. Let's take a question from over here.
How do you feel your work has changed the world? How do you feel you've changed the world?
I have no idea. I have no idea. That my answer to that would depend completely on my mood in any given moment. And when I'm down in the dumps, my feeling is I didn't do a damn thing. I wrote all these books. They didn't have much effect. My friends come around and say, oh, what are you talking about? You've had a huge effect. I say, ah, you're full of it, and you know it, and so forth and so on. And when I get into a good mood, I get scared because I say, oh, you're getting manic again. Watch it. So I can't answer your question. But my feeling is history is going to tell. Either I will end up, as I hope I will, having a considerable effect on thinking in America, at least, and maybe a little bit in the rest of the world, or I may have none.
It's not really a question about what the result is, but I was really wondering what you wanted to do in terms of changing the world and change of raising consciousness.
I wanted to open the consciousness of America. I wanted to open the consciousness of my time. I wanted people to get rid of their, what I considered their circumscribing notions. I've always felt that, for example, that patriotism is one of the most abused of all emotions, because blind patriotism is a vice. So I want people to think that way. Oh, yes, blind patriotism is a vice. Sensitive, critical patriotism is a virtue. Well, that would be a way to open people's minds.
What is it about Hitler that has made him almost uniquely representative of evil?
He murdered millions of people by category. His competitor in evil was Joseph Stalin. But Stalin killed people. Stalin was also a monster, but he was a human monster that we can comprehend. He was a very hard, cruel, determined man who was determined to win at all costs, and he saw his enemy as someone to be destroyed. But he was killing his enemy. The difference is Hitler was creating an enemy that was not an enemy, but he had chosen to make them an enemy. So it was a much more cowardly sort of mass murder. Not that I'm defending either variety of mass murder, but Hitler's was a far worse variety of mass murder than Stalin's. And after Stalin and Hitler, I don't know who you're going to compare them to. I mean, it's a joke to talk about Saddam Hussein in the same sentence as Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin.
Well, thanks so much, Norman Mailer.
Novelist Norman Mailer, who wrote more than 36 books in his six-decade-long career and twice won the Pulitzer Prize. Mailer died this month in Manhattan. He was 84. His appearance in January at Hunter College was part of the New York Times Times Talks series. Mailer's last novel was a fictional account of Adolf Hitler. It is titled The Castle in the Forest. If you missed part of today's program with Norman Mailer, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may listen anytime by going to our website, wordforword.org. There, you may also subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by JFK speechwriter Ted Sorensen, Second Lady Liz Cheney, and political writers Bill Kristol and Paul Krugman. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Sam Keenan. American Public Media.